I wanted him dead. And throwing him off the second-story porch of the balcony where I lived would have been too good for him. I wanted to kill him. And not just that, I wanted to kill all of his relatives too. It was, admittedly, a very drastic response, reflexive, sudden, and quite certain. But what made it all the more compelling is that I held not a doubt in my brain that he thought exactly the same way about me. And then, as we were only inches from one another, he moved his arm ever so slightly, and I screamed. It was the third time that I had screamed in less than a minute. And since I was the age of 35, hysterical screamer was not the descriptive which I was eager to have other people identify me by. And that only served to increase the certainty that I wanted him dead. Me and my arachnid housemate were not going to see eye to beady little eye. Let me back up and describe my world before that minute so you will know how fear works. I had just been called to the church in Atlanta, and I had been moving into a new apartment, and it was a hot summer afternoon, and I had been carrying the boxes up the stairs for hours. My apartment overlooked the pool, so I decided to fix a glass of sweet tea and take a break out on the balcony. And so, carrying a folding chair and my glass of tea, I opened the patio door, waved to the dozen or so people about 30 feet away in the pool, took two more steps out into my balcony, and walked face first into the mother of all spider webs. And in the suffocating, claustrophobic sensation that followed, I panicked. The chair and the tea went flying, and I began furiously flailing my arms back and forth, trying to get this dirty, sticky web goo from my face, which, after I got it out of my eyes and out of my mouth, is what brought on the first involuntary scream. But now, backed against the balcony wall, my brain shifted from involuntary response to voluntary thought, and the very first question that came to my brain was, wow, a spider that big must have been what created a web of that size. Whereupon such spider of nightmarish proportions scurried up that web right next to my face. This, of course, sent my panic level from orange to red, compelling me to scramble even further back against the wall. But since the web line holding the spider was also attached to my face, the spider followed me, hence the second scream. At this point, dangling about 10 inches and stuck there in front of my face, all it took was the slightest twitch of his little arm for me to become completely unglued and scream number three. It was at this point that all the mothers around the pool began gathering their children and hurrying them to the exits at the far end of the complex away from my apartment. That's how fear works. That's how it spreads. That's how it enters into and changes our lives. How many of us can identify with such a story? Maybe you've had bouts with spiders or bouts with spider webs yourselves, or maybe you've just been one of those parents who pull your children back when you see a strange, screaming man flailing off invisible attackers. Or maybe knowing that he's a minister, you stay away from his church. Or maybe you just stay away from churches in general because you've gotten a clear picture over the years. That's mostly what goes on in churches these days. Strange, screaming men flailing off invisible attackers. How many of us can identify with that? I think most of us can identify in one way or another because it goes much beyond those who are afraid of spiders and churches. So this morning I would like to talk about fear. And in particular, I'd like to talk about our response to fear. A friend of mine, Meg Barnhouse, writes about the time that she was street captain of her neighborhood community building program, a job that required her to go door to door, collecting dues and checking in with people. And she noticed upon knocking that people would undo locks, sometimes a whole series of locks, and then peek around the door while the chain was still attached. And almost without exception, she noticed that fear had taken hold of everyone in the neighborhood, and they were hostage to that fear. And mostly what they were afraid of was one another. She heard a couple stories from those experiences that are worth retelling. The first from someone who spoke of how when he grew up driving through the bad part of town and he was taught to reach undetectably across to push down the lock on the door, undetectably. He learned it needed to be undetectable because once when his sister reached out and deliberately slammed the lock down, their mother turned to the back seat and hissed at them and said, "Don't make it so obvious. You don't want to hurt their feelings." The other story is from Jack, a friend of Meg's, who lived in a dangerous neighborhood by anyone's standards. He said, "I could see two crack houses from my front porch." And then he said something surprising. He said that when he would go out camping, he would always leave his door open. "Open as in unlocked?" Meg asked. "No, open as in the door is wide open. Nothing is ever touched. I go camping with my family. They is usually the only ones I've ever known to mess with my things. Strangers don't hardly ever bother you here, especially when you leave your door open." "I think we're scared of the wrong things," Meg said. "We lock our car doors and we take our kids home to where the guns are. We say, 'Beware of pedophile strangers,' but don't think of protecting them from relatives or friends of the family. We never open our doors to neighbors, so they never know and are never there when we are in need. We're scared of people. We're afraid of getting to know them, but we don't want to hurt their feelings." "I think we're scared of the wrong things," says Meg. And nowhere is that more true than in America. We are the land of the free. And freedom may have many connotations, but apparently it doesn't apply to a freedom from constant preoccupation with anxiety or suspicion or the devastating amount of time and energy we spend consciously or unconsciously trying desperately to protect ourselves, reaching over and undetectably locking the doors of our life and our heart until both become impenetrable. We seldom recognize how much of our time, our attention, or even our money we pour into establishing these military zones around our heart. Think about these statistics. Our country's budget for military and homeland security for 2012 is $740 billion, nearly $750 billion. That is 10 times the amount that we spend on education. The same thinking prevails in the private sector as well. In 2010, the NRA listed that there were 300 million guns registered in the U.S. and countless more that are unregistered. The number of guns in circulation exceeds the U.S. adult population. The number one stated reason why we have those guns is, quote, to defend ourselves and our family. And yet, a recent FBI uniform crime report documents in 1 year that there were only 154 incidents where a gun was successfully used to protect a private citizen from attack, compared to 8,529 incidents of murder with a firearm. All of which tell me that we may very well be free to bear arms and free to declare war on a foreign enemy, but we have a long way to go before we are free from fear, which will continue as long as we hold on to this commitment to be reflexive instead of reflective. Our response to fear is largely dictated by the limbic portion of our brain, designed to be highly attuned to danger and triggering automated defense mechanisms. And the good news is that after that portion of our brain was developed 50,000 years ago, it is still in great working order. Our limbic brain works like this. When danger is perceived, it sends out a signal to our amygdala, which in turn initiates a cascade of physical responses automatically. Blood is diverted away from secondary organs like the kidney and stomach in order to go to the head and the heart. So things like rational thought is suspended or delayed. Digestion or regenerative processes are also shut down. It is a time for action, not reflection or digestion. Our pupils dilate in order to see better in lower light. Hair stands on end on our arms in order to be more sensitive to movement. Air passages like our lungs, our nose, our throat open up, allowing us to breathe faster and also to scream louder. Sweat glands open, anticipating the need to run, causing our skin to become clammy. These are all automatic responses. And it's interesting that 50,000 years ago, even though we upgraded our mental operating system by developing a cerebral cortex whose primary function is to reason, to offer thinking and problem-solving skills far more complex than the limbic brain is able to do. But the interesting thing is that the breaker switch for that cerebral cortex still lay in the limbic brain. We live in an age where terror and dread seem present all the time. And our media sources, especially outlets like Fox News, operate on the well-proven understanding that, quote, if you want to get people's attention, scare them, which is more manipulation than information. Hence, our limbic brains are running all the time, and we are psychologically and physiologically exhausted, constantly trying to defend ourselves. It is also a case where we often know the least about what scares us the most. It's interesting to note that this is not a new thing. Early cartographers, those who drew and made maps to share about what was around the world, often revealed this. When they came to the edges of their maps, to the territories that had not been explored or could not have been charted, they were known to fill that space in with the cautionary words, "Beyond this place, there be dragons." The maps conveyed perhaps unintended consequences of discouraging any further education or exploration by posting the threat of dragons. But in today's time, even though we don't have dragons, we have what many people call demons. The things that loom largest are not on the horizon in front of us, but in our imagination within us. And when our imaginations become so full of these frightening notions spill out over into our lives and we attach them onto the people around us. In psychological terms, this is often called projection, where we assume our worst fears are actually the characteristics of the people around us, especially those who we know the least about become most susceptible to our projection. This response has inflicted great pain over the centuries. The Catholic Church projected their fears onto the Jews during the Inquisition, and the Nazis did likewise during the Holocaust. Our forebears in this country projected their fears upon strong or assertive women during the Salem witch hunts. And it continues to this day with almost everything that is foreign to us. Other countries, other religions, people who don't look or act or talk just like us. It's an all too familiar story, and the basis by which racism, classism, ageism, sexism, and homophobia maintain their power in our culture. So what can we do? Today, I'm going to suggest three things. Name your fear. Resist that limbic cascade of messages prompting us to fight, flight, or freeze. And third, try doing what Religio did in this morning story, or what Rebecca Parker suggested in the reflection. Employ the spiritual discipline of intentionally positing and pointing yourself toward your fear. Yesterday, about 40 of us came together for a great conversation about this community, and specifically about where we're at and where we might like to go in the future. We talked about what happens here at Brew that feels incredibly energizing, and we also talked about some of the things that feel sometimes confusing, or where we feel stuck, or where energy is lost. We noticed that that latter category had quite a few things that we could list, which, as you go through a list like that in your life or in anything that you're involved in, can by itself feel energy draining and scary. But what made our work spiritual is that we resisted the automated impulses for fight, flight, or freeze. Instead, we committed ourselves to holding that tension, which existed within a group of people who we looked around and saw were brilliant, were thoughtful, were loyal, were committed. All of the characteristics that you need to come together and figure out a common solution. We worked to lay out the challenges without expending energy defending ourselves or justifying our problems or with any commitment to staying stuck. And if you missed the meeting yesterday and you want to help us by naming some of those things that are energizing to you or where energy is lost, there are two sheets of paper in Fellowship Hall that are labeled such. Take a moment to write something down that you feel is really energizing in this committee, or where you think that energy is being lost that could be channeled back in. Together, we will work to figure out ways where we can spend more on education than on defense. And I think what we will begin to discover is what I think the world needs to discover. That it's not that there isn't anything out there to be afraid of. There are things all over the world to be legitimately afraid of. But as Meg says, we're often afraid of the wrong things. We should really be afraid of our response to fear. That it is too often more reflexive than reflective. What would happen if we learned to do like Jack learned to do, to unlock all the doors and leave them open, the doors of our minds, the doors of our hearts, in those places where our minds were open, we could find common solution. Where our hearts were open, we could work together as allies. After I finally managed to free myself from that sticky, icky web goo on my face, which connected me to my spider, and I got back into my apartment, my breathing returned to normal. My anger at being so frightened subsided a little, but my apprehension continued. I thought about following that Unitarian Universalist mantra that me and my icky little arachnid would just agree to disagree. But I realized that because that strategy never goes beyond mere tolerance of one another, and mere tolerance is miles away from understanding and acceptance, I wanted something more to happen. So the first thing that I did was I named my little friend. I called him Boris, from the Who song, Boris the Spider. For me, it was harder to hate somebody with whom I was on a first name basis and who liked the same music that I liked. Secondly, I began asking questions, and I realized that I was suddenly in a war I could not win. Did you know that spiders have been around for 350 million years? Compare that to the 50,000 years for human beings, and you get an idea of where we each stand on the adaptability scale of existence. And they severely outnumber us, too. 60 to 70,000 per suburban acre. They are never aggressive, and with very few exceptions, they are harmless. They are an important part of what keeps our environmental interdependent system in balance by eating bugs that destroy vegetation. I learned that declaring war and vowing to get rid of every last spider would probably become my problem rather than solve my problem. But then again, my fear-based urge to declare war wasn't based on reason. And that's the insidious part of fear. It works to keep reason and understanding and acceptance at a minimum, because that is where fear has the most power. There is a German proverb that states that fear is what makes the wolf look bigger than he is. That is what Religio discovered after she was willing to approach all the lions and tigers and bears and slimy ooze, sluggy things. And that's what we discover when we bring to bear the full capacity of our heart, of our mind, of our soul. We grow in stature, and what we're afraid of shrinks before us. Such is the path between the animals and the beastie beasts. It really will save us from screaming, flailing men trying to ward off invisible attackers, for it will offer us courage and diminish fear. It will allow us to lay down our sword and shield and find a better course for our lives. May that be our way. May we do it together. May we do it with joy.